The meeting of Agriculture and Rural Economies Committee together. Thank you everyone for coming to the meeting. Since session ran a little late, some of the folks wanted to go back to their offices a minute and do some, bring their computers back and work and whatnot. And so we started a little late. We may run a little long. We'll see how that goes. But we will start. Here's the way the schedule will go today. We will finish the presentation from the Department of Ag and the Board of Animal Health. And then we will leave, I estimate we'll leave about 10 minutes at the end to hear the three bills we've got up. Senator Deems has a bill, and I have a couple of them to work on those. In your packets here, you have some information that we requested the other day from the department concerning the ethanol payments, who has what due to them. So you'll have that information as we talk about those issues later on when we put together, when we mark up our omnibus bill and do that. So keep that information for yourself in your files, and if you have questions certainly about that, we can. The department's here to answer those. And, so any questions about the agenda for today? All right. Welcome Greta Gauthier from the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Start in where we left off the other day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did speak with your staff about this briefly, if you could indulge me one moment. I did bring something for the members that's hot off of our presses regarding to spring flooding this year in Minnesota. We have just finished a couple of handouts updated, and also our website is updated with a lot of external links regarding forecasts and so on. But a basic impact of the flood, and then some detailed sheets stapled together that have information for different types of producers as to what they can do to prepare. So, for example, storage of seed and feed. What should a dairy farmer do? What about if you have anhydrous storage on your facility, and so on? And the reason I pass this on is the flooding is predicted to be, as you know, fairly severe this year, and we are trying our best to get the word out to everybody that there are things people can do to prepare. And so I give you this and suggested if you are interested, it might be a nice column for a local newspaper or something to have with you when you're talking to constituents. We'd greatly appreciate it. We're trying harder than ever this year to get the word out about how people can get ready. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gauthier. And again, I would emphasize that too, members. Contact your constituents, the folks in your areas. Talk to them about, unless we have a miraculous change in the weather here, we're likely going to face some issues here. And let's make sure we do some preparedness for this. That's why we've asked all the departments to come back to us with some ideas that we can kick around about the possible flooding situation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, yes, we can, as we discuss, we'll pick up, Mr. Chairman, where we left off, which was page 33 of the governor's budget document. And at this point, we are going through the various divisions of our agency and just giving a brief overview. And we can look at the spreadsheet on page 35. This division, again, is still under our Protection Services Program, but this is our Laboratory Services Division. And as many of you know, we are co-located with the Minnesota Department of Health, and we do share laboratory equipment with them. And this has proved to be a very economical, effective, efficient way of using that expensive equipment to the fullest extent. With me here, excuse me. Pardon me. With me here, I have Gary.
Horvath.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm new. Gary Horvath to take us through the overview and answer any questions that members may have, Mr. Chairman.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Horvath. How are you today?
I'm very good, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Did you state your name for the record and tell us what's going on with your division?
Yes, Chairman. My name for the record is Gary Horvath. I'm the director of the Laboratory Services Division at the Department of Agriculture. And The lab's main mission is to provide legally and scientifically defensible data to the other protection services divisions. So I thought what I'd do is I'd go through that real quickly, give you a taste of what we do, and then walk through our other programs. As you heard testimony before, the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division is one of our biggest customers. We do all of the groundwater, surface water, pesticide testing, the nutrient testing. We do the enforcement testing for pesticide drift and misuse, human exposure. We do pesticide residue testing and just about anything you can think of. Our second biggest customer is our Dairy and Food Inspection Division. We do food testing, dairy testing, meat testing for pathogens such as Salmonella, E. coli, Listeria. We do compositional chemistry testing, looking at the labels, making sure what's in there is in there. We respond to consumer complaints for adulterations, foreign matter, that type of thing. We do toxin identification in food such as patchouli and apple juice and mycotoxin in feed, that type of thing. We also can do species identification. Someone's selling 100% ground beef and they suspect it's not, we can do that type of work. We do some nutritional labeling, and we also do pasteurized milk ordinance testing, which allows Minnesota farmers to ship their milk interstate. There are certain chemical tests and biological tests that we have to do for that. We have a smaller plant protection division program. We do our main program there is our seed analysis. We do testing for germination and purity and some genetic traits, although not that much, and we have some limited capacity for plant disease. That's an area we see as potentially growing, and the agency is discussing how we position ourselves, or do we position ourselves to respond to, you know, the globalization bringing in new diseases. So we're constantly looking at that issue. Those are our three main department customers. In addition to that, we are the Department of Natural Resources Chemistry Laboratory. About 15 years ago, the Department of Natural Resources closed their lab in Hibbing and closed their lab at Carlos Avery. So we do all of the lakes and streams nutrient testing for, you know, limnological testing of lakes, looking at the quality of lakes and streams. We do all their hatchery permit testing that they need to do to be in compliance with Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And we do some various pond studies and special projects for them. We also, and that's for the Ecological Services Division, we also get special projects like looking at goose tissue, going to food shelves for toxins, a variety of things like that. We're also within the DNR. We're the lab for their Division of Lands and Minerals. That's their work up in, mainly up in the North Shore, looking at high sulfide-bearing ores, the extraction of metallic minerals such as gold and silver, and the various deposits that you find with that. And one of the big issues there, as you know, or probably may deal with soon, is once that ore is extracted and exposed to oxygen, it combines with moisture and forms sulfuric acid and leaches out heavy metals. That's a major issue. So we work with their division up there to look at remediation. They have some test plots that they try to do various things to get at that. We also do occasionally samples for other agencies. It's more as on an ad hoc basis. We do some criminal investigations for pesticide, criminal use of pesticides such as homicides or assaults using pesticide poisons. We'll do that work because of our specialization in that area. We do some work for transportation, and most of those are on an ad hoc basis. In addition, we have four major federal grants, three with USDA. The pesticide database program is a program that looks at pesticide residues. We have the contract to do water testing, and what that is we're looking at very low levels of pesticides in water, and they take that data and share it with the EPA As part of their risk analysis, it's used to set tolerances for total exposure. We also have a microbiological database program. We're looking at method development and the frequency of pathogens in fresh produce. One of our biggest and I think really valuable programs through the federal government is what's called the Food Emergency Response Network. This is administered both by USDA and FDA. This is looking for terroristic threat agents in food. The USDA portion deals with pathogens. There's a variety of pathogens which are deemed to be highly toxic and at risk for use in a terroristic threat. So we have a contract with them. We're one of 13 states to have that. That's provided us a lot of equipment in these tough times and really has helped bolster our food pathogen work. And we do method development for them and get called in on special projects. We were the lab, as you know, that identified salmonella and peanut butter. A lot of that was because of some of the equipment and expertise that we've developed under that program. And also the mirror image of that is the Food and Drug Administration Food Emergency Response Network. And that's a similar program, but that's looking at chemical terrorist agents. There's a number of medications and highly toxic chemicals that could be used and a threat to the food supply. So we do method development, and we've been activated 3 times. We were involved with the melamine. We were Minnesota in a position to be one of the first states to be able to process state samples. As a consequence, we identified a couple products still on the shelves that were missed by the feds. We were able to initiate a recall and get those off the shelf, so that really positioned us well. We're also activated for the Gulf disaster. We were one of 2 labs that came up with a fast method to identify polyaromatic hydrocarbons in shellfish, and we helped get that jump started. And so we're very proud of our laboratory. We have great capability, and these programs really help us. What our activity in that and all of our activities really serve the people of Minnesota and the department's mission to protect food safety, protect the environment from agricultural chemical spills or misuse, and ensure a safe food supply. With that, that's kind of a summary of what we do, and I'll jump to our budget, and I have the sheet on page 35. In a nutshell, our general fund is roughly 42%, and a key point I'd like to get through to the members of the committee here is that 51% of that goes to our rent or to pay down the bond and operate our facility. Our facility was built in 2004. We moved in. It's a state-of-the-art facility with high containment labs, and there's large operational costs. But it really is a resource for the state. And so half of our general fund goes to that cost. In addition, our agricultural fund, dedicated fees. I talked about some of those programs: feed, meat, dairy. That type of thing is 29%, and we have 29% as federal dollars, which are the grants that I talked about. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions on the budget or any questions.
Mr. Horvath, you talked about some of the work we're doing for our friends at the natural resources.
Yes.
And, are they helping support the yes, lab and the minerals and so on? And where does that fund? Do you have that shown on your breakout here, or?
Mr. Chairman, that's reflected in our agricultural fund. We have a cooperative agreement with the Department of Natural Resources that we enter into every 2 years, and we look at costs and we negotiate that, and then that money comes into us and is reflected in the agricultural fund.
And how about your miscellaneous special revenue funds? What again was that?
Mr. Chairman, we have authority in statute to recover costs. I can't remember the exact statute number, but in a case like that, we'll negotiate a price on a per sample basis, and then we will invoice those agencies.
Okay. So, and as I see it, Mr. Horvath, that work is increasing for you.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. For instance, we just were approached by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. They wanted to do additional fish sampling for mercury and PCBs, which we also do for the DNR. We are the lab that does that work for fish consumption advisories, and they wanted to do some additional fish to get at some issues they have, and so we entered into a cooperative agreement with them, and that all goes into that fund.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Senator Kubley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Horvath. Back when you were talking about looking for pathogens in produce, are there certain kinds of produce that you're more apt to find acting as a host for pathogens? And I assume you try and trace a pathogen back to the source. So I was wondering if there is a source that is a more common source for pathogens in produce than others that you locate.
Mr. Horvath?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I can't say that any particular produce under the MDP program, which I talked about, is prevalent over another. There are certain products such that like bean sprouts and things where you recycle a lot of the water is recycled or has a potential to be recycled and can get contaminated. There are certain conditions that favor pathogen growth. But in the produce coming in from the field, a lot of time that's, and for instance, in the outbreak, the alleged tomato outbreak that ended up being peppers, that particular outbreak was traced back, once it was identified as peppers, they trace it back to two fields in Mexico where they had a large population of coyotes, and the coyotes' fecal matter was all over it, and that's where it comes from. So the animal, keeping animals excluded from your crop is difficult, as you know, and so it really is kind of hit or miss, and conditions have to be right, and so there is no prevalent produce that I can, you know, point out.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Horvath, would it help if I sent the farmers south of the border a copy of my coyote bill?
Good point, Senator. Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Horvath, you had alluded to earlier about doing laboratory work for the DNR and the fisheries. Can you tell me how many dollars are built into the 2011 budget for that work, the funds you're receiving back from those folks for doing their work?
Mr. Horvath?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't have the exact figure, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $250,000 in total for the DNR, I believe. But I can get that figure for you.
That would be,
you.
If you could, I would appreciate that, yes. Too, if you could respond to that. Okay, thank you. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you just elaborate just a little bit, and I apologize if I maybe should have known this, what is the relationship to the Department of Health in terms of the facility? According to this on the budget sheet, it says that you pay rent for the lab facility. Is that owned by the Department of Health?
Mr. Horvath?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no. The lab was bonded. And it was intended to house both agencies. We pay a 40% portion of the total total rent that's due. Health is paying 60% of that, and we're co-located in there. We share, when we designed the building, we made sure, you know, one of the aspects of co-locating was to double up on, you know, very expensive utilities like gas distribution, steam for our autoclaves and all of that. But we have segregated those fees internally, and we have some cooperative agreements that spell that out.
Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Stumpf?
Is the treatment of or the cost any different for that facility than it would be, let's say, for another agency's facility that where the rent And I'm trying to figure out if there's any way that your agency might be able to save some money. I think that this was built in 2006.
Senator, we moved in 2004.
So the management and budget actually, refinance when the opportune time comes for that bond, or?
Mr. Horvath?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't believe that's been looked at. The building was built to our specifications. As far as if you're talking about moving to another facility, that would be very difficult because of the height, the nature of the containment that we built then. As far as renegotiating that's beyond my knowledge. I don't have an answer for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Horvath.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we'll move on then. The next program area in our department is promotion and marketing. Purpose of this is to bolster our state's agricultural sector, economic and environmental health. And we have a number of activities within this. So if you are on page 37 and 38, you can see a overall spreadsheet for all our promotion and marketing. And then following that, we go into some of the more specific individual programs. So I have with me Deputy Commissioner Jim Bourbon, who's here to discuss this aspect and program of our agency and answer questions, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. How are you today?
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's good to be here. For the record, I'm Jim Bourbon, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Agriculture. I'm going to cover the two budget activities that are within the marketing and promotion section. The first budget activity is agriculture marketing services, and the programs are highlighted beginning on page 39 of your budget document. But essentially, the programs in this division assist in the orderly marketing of Minnesota agriculture commodities and products. We promote Minnesota agriculture products in both domestic and international markets. We provide economic analysis related to market opportunities, and we provide marketing services to producers, processors, and consumers. And I'll give you some examples within each of those areas. Some of the activities that we use to promote Minnesota products is we have staff that partner with the U.S. Department of Agriculture as well as commodity councils and trade groups to participate in international shows. In the last biennium, we participated in 11 international food shows and 86 international trade events. We hosted trade officials from 60 different countries. Some examples of activities that offer economic analysis, we have Sue Yees, a staff person on our department. Every year, she writes a profile of Minnesota's agriculture industry and its contribution to our state economy. That information is on our website. She also does some work that provides some technical assistance and economic analysis on renewable fuels. And as you know, there's always a conversation about the influence of renewable fuels on food costs and other livestock activities. The third area, again, on some of the work that we do to support producers, processors, and consumers. Examples of that, we have staff that are part of essentially a livestock development team that's led by Kurt Zimmerman. They can work directly with livestock producers and coach or mentor them through the permitting process. If a producer is looking to upgrade or expand their facility, they can help them through this permitting process. We have staff that administer the Dairy Development and Profitability Program, as well as our Dairy Business Planning Grants. And Paul Huguenin on our staff administers, with a couple other employees, our Minnesota Grown Program. That is one of our highlight programs. At the present time, we've got 840 farms or small businesses that are part of this Minnesota Grown Directory. So that's been really a growth opportunity for the agency. And it's an opportunity where both consumers and producers can enjoy some economic benefit of locally grown produce. spending for this budget activity under agriculture marketing services is highlighted on page 41. You can see that the governor's recommendation for fiscal year 12 and 13 is $6.2 million. We receive $1.9 million in general fund monies, an equal amount of about $1.8 million in agriculture funds or dedicated funds, and then about $2.5 million federal funds. The spending of that then is about $4.3 million in staff and operating costs. That includes the rent, again, for our share of the building space, and then about $1.9 million in local assistance. So that's a very quick snapshot on the ag marketing services. And then if there's no questions on that, I can move forward to the next section.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Borbom, does the department have an administrative cost with their oversight of the Commodity Promotion and Research Councils?
Yes.
Commissioner Borbom?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator, we do. The level of our oversight is not as a fiscal agent, but only to make sure that the checkoff funds as they're collected and as the contracts are worked out or executed with different vendors like the University of Minnesota or others, is to make sure that the money is spent appropriately within the statutory guidelines so that it's for research and promotion purposes only.
And, Mr. Chair,
Senator Scoy.
So I wasn't clear on that. Do you take an administrative charge for that?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, we do not. I should say, though, let me clarify, we do negotiate an annual a contract or a fee with the commodity councils to help cover costs. So I should correct myself by saying that we don't, we do just like a $10,000, $12,000 annual fee to cover those costs.
Thank you.
And Commissioner, how many councils now do you have?
There are, Mr. Chairman, there are 13 councils that we have oversight on.
Right. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
The next activity then is summarized beginning on page 42. This would be the Agriculture Development and Financial Assistance Division. And again, both of these budget activities were merged into the new division, but for purposes of the budget overview, I'll just stay with the existing model. But the programs in this division, we sponsor research and demonstration projects to improve environmental quality, offer outreach and technical assistance to growers, and also provide some low-cost financing to Minnesota farmers. And again, I'll give you some examples with each of those program areas. One of the activities that we do to support water quality is we have a staff person that works with some individuals, farm organizations, and the university on some demonstration drainage systems, conservation and demonstration drainage systems. These are in 14 different locations throughout the state. And the benefit of that is that we can help see how design of drainage systems influence water quality. Some other examples that we offer in some outreach and technical assistance to Minnesota growers. This is really one of the hearts of this budget activity. We have staff that work with the Natural Resource Conservation Service to write grazing plans for beef producers. We have profile successful farm practices that support both sustainable agriculture and organic growers with demonstration grants. We have employees that help sponsor and coordinate an annual organic conference every year in St. Cloud. Mary Hanks is here today, and she and Meg Moynihan and a couple others really do a great job with that. I think there was nearly 500 people that attended this conference this last year, and so it's a great opportunity to get technical information out to those clientele. We also have staff that administer a new entity that I think was for about 3 years now. We've offered some scholarship assistance to organic growers to participate in the farm management program, and that's a great way, again, for others that are looking to transition into that entity and for lenders then to get some basis, some financial information for that type of operation. And then finally, we have employees that manage and staff the biological control and plant pathology facility at the University of Minnesota. And again, Dr. Mary Hanks handles that. We'll close with some of the programs that offer low-cost financing. You're very familiar with those, such as the Livestock Investment Grant Program that we've administered for a couple of years, the Sustainable Agriculture Grant and Loan Program, the Agriculture Best Management Program, and the Minnesota Rural Finance Authority, all examples of low-cost financing programs that we offer. The governor's recommendation on this program can be found on page 44, and you can see there's a difference or a change there from the $5.54 million in the previous biennium to $4.77 million in the current biennium, or to the fiscal year 12-13 biennium. Again, that reflects the change recommendation that we talked about at earlier meetings. So, again, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I'll close with that and have any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Borboom. And I'll remind the members also, we'll be having our Clean Water Day, or our chance to tell the agriculture story. A lot of good things in here. You look through this if you get time, but we will be having a day in March, a nice long day to talk about, have our story told. So we've heard the others tell our story. Now it's time for us to tell our story. Thank you very much, Mr. Borboom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next section is our value-added products. And Steve Ernest, the head of our financial division, is going to take us through this.
Hello, Mr. Ernest. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. All right.
Steve Ernest. Sorry, for the record, Mr. Chairman, Steve Ernest, Finance and Budget Director with the Department of Agriculture. So this program begins on page 45, and it lists the two sides of the program. We're finishing up the bioenergy ethanol specific side, and then moving on to the ag growth research and innovation program side, which we have started, but this is kind of pulling it together now. In this program, page 46 summarizes the two sides and shows that we had $9.9 million each year of the current biennium that was used for the ethanol payments, and you had the one-page handout that we brought in when we talked about those previously, and then the previous laws had put back the $5.22 million one-time cuts that you can see on that page there. So our base amount for this program is $14.7 million. So that's our starting point. And then, as we talked about in the change item, we just shifted a little in order to be able to have $15 million in the first year to pay off all the remaining deficiency amounts that we have calculated, and then reducing the second year to get $5.48 million for the agri programs. Page 47 talks about the bioenergy activities, and specifically what we're talking about here is the ethanol, because the next-gen type activities we will be moving in will be on the agri side, covered under the agri program it's created in statute. So agri is described starting on page 49, the second part of this program. And I would just point out on page 50 the history that of past efforts in these areas. We've had $3 million appropriated for next-gen grants in fiscal 2008 and $1 million for livestock investment grants in 2010. But those were in a different area, so they don't show up on the numbers page on page 51. They'll show up in the financial assistance.
Could you state those numbers again?
$3 million for next-gen grants, mm-hmm, and $1 million for livestock investment grants.
No one's on this page.
Thank you.
On page 50 talks about those. Those numbers. So then the $5 million would be allocated to those and other eligible programs in consultation with the chairs as the opportunities arise starting in the second year of the biennium.
Okay.
Governor's budget. And then I would move into the admin and financial assistance program if there are no other questions.
Right. Any questions? If not, go ahead, Steve, and move
okay
on to...
Yep. Starting on page 52, we have the two sides to this, our grants and assistance side and then our agency services side. Grants and assistance, I'll point out the biggest items in that. We have $634,000 for the dairy profitability and enhancement teams and program grants and teams each year. We have $474,000 each year for county fair money to to help them with their programs. We have $500,000 each year for the milk grants, for the food shelves. And then there are a series of separate pass-through grant monies that are listed out in the bill as riders. The biggest from the general fund, they are for the Livestock Breeders Association, the Northern Crops Institute, the Horticulture Society, Turf and Forage Research Council, and the Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council, which is housed at the University of Minnesota.
Mr. Ernst, how much does the Northern Crops Institute, how much is that grant?
Currently, we have $47,000 per year in the base.
Okay. And you're anticipating to continue that on?
Yep, it's in the base as is. There are no changes
recommended
to that. Another big program in here is our Farmers Market Program. There are two sides to that, the Women, Infant, and Children, WIC side, that's a USDA Food Nutrition Service program, and then the Senior Farmers Market Program. So we get about $400,000 a year from the federal government for those programs, and then we have a required match on the WIC part of it, and put in about $175,000 each year from the general fund. And I would point out we did get $4 million in disaster money in this activity also, which shows up as a one-time appropriation reduction, pulling it out of the base. So that was kind of the blip in 11 there.
Mr. Ernst, can you give me an update on the status of that fund? Are we, how much was that again, and what's the situation right now with that?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, we have awarded about $1 million in grant money assistance. We are open to taking disaster loan applications, and I believe since the grants have just finished, we haven't received too much in loan applications yet. I'm not sure of the numbers. And we have a couple contracts that are being finalized for some local assistance through Lutheran Social Services, and I forget the name of the other provider.
Maybe you could get some
rural mental health.
Mr. Maybe. Chairman, those services are rural mental health programs to help the farmers that suffered in the flooding of last spring cope with some of the stresses of it. And then for the individual payments to the farmers, I believe we made payments to 94 different farmers, and those were in that $1 million.
Okay. Maybe you could get those numbers to us then.
Those numbers and the numbers on the loans, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nelson.
Chairman, I have a question. Thank you for indulging me. I'm wondering if you can visit with me a minute about that WIC funding. You said there's a match that we're required to have, and I'm just wondering what that match is and if the level of our match is what is required by the Fed. Sometimes we exceed the Feds, and I just want to know what the status of that is here.
Mr. Ernst?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't have the exact numbers. I do know that because the match requirement has been reduced, we have more than is required at the moment. I can get you the exact numbers, though.
Yes, I'd like to know what's required and what we are matching.
Yep.
Thank you.
Senator Benson.
Yes, and looking at the WIC program again, and I'm just learning, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe WIC is given in the form of a voucher in the state of Minnesota, but this goes out as a check. So can you tell me what kind of assurances we have that this is actually being used for food assistance, that it's being used at farmers markets?
Mr. Ernst?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, our program uses a separate, it's not the WIC programs themselves, the coupons themselves, but they are coupons that are given to the vendors at the farmers markets, and then the vendors get their money from us when they turn in the coupons. And I know we do have detailed records of what vendors got how much, and we could provide more information on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Benson, would you like more information from the department on that? I know you're working with this. You and I have talked about it this morning, and I know where you're working on that.
I'd actually like to know what how it compares to the WIC program, and really you refer to issuing checks, and so that's what threw me off a little bit here. If you're dealing with the voucher system, I'd like to see how that system works in parallel with WIC, because we want to make sure that those funds are going to the people who need them, and so let's tighten down on that.
Okay, any more questions? Does that complete your presentation, Mr.
Mr. Chairman? Then I just those numbers are summarized on page 56.
Okay.
And then on page 59 we have the numbers for the agency services. These are the Commissioner's Office, the Finance and Budget Office, the Human Resources. It also includes Ag Statistics, which is a partnership with the U.S. Ag Statistics Program, and our IT. Our information technology division. There are about 55 staff people here, or FTEs, and only about 17 of those are funded from the general fund. Most of the funding, it comes from the agency indirects. That is shown as miscellaneous special revenue on the numbers page.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of information, the flooding fact sheets and that communication effort and being prepared as an agency to help prepare Minnesota's producers for the flood, those services are all provided through our agency services division.
And Mr. Ernst, are you going to include any equine information in your ag statistics now?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, if the statute requires us to do that, we would be happy to comply.
Okay. Sure.
Okay. That does, with the exception of our federal funding, Mr. Chairman, beginning on page, the spreadsheet begins on page 61, but there's some explanation on page 60. It goes through page 62 and 63. Excuse me, not, yes, 63. And that will show you... I know there's been an interest, and as always, we are interested when our expenditures can be matched by the feds. So you can get some of that information here. And then the final page, 64, Mr. Chairman, is just a summary of the revenue coming into the agency as a whole.
Mr. Chairman, I would point out that we do bring in over $3 million to the general fund every year. Most of that is the food retail food money, food fees, but retail is the biggest of the food fees, and that's one that we're requesting our 15% increase, and then to be appropriated back to us the increased amount.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, does that conclude the?
Concludes the Department of Agriculture's presentation, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for having us and for all your great questions.
Good job, and thanks for your patience in working through this with us.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ernest is going to leave the table, but I'm staying here and putting on a different hat because I am also Government Relations Director for the Board of Animal Health.
Right.
And so I will ask Dr. Bill Hartman, State Veterinarian, Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health, to come forward now. And you should have a tab in your governor's budget document for the Board of Animal Health, and we can work through from there.
Good afternoon, Dr. Hartman.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
How's it going today?
Good. It's very, very good.
Great. Okay. Bill, go ahead and start out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. We've already provided you with an overview of what the Board of Animal Health does, so today we're going to just move right into the budget. And with me is Beth Thompson, who's a senior veterinarian with the Board of Animal Health. She's going to provide you with a look at the governor's recommendations for the next biennium. But before she does that, I'll talk a little bit about our current budget for this biennium. And it's relatively straightforward and simple, so it won't take us a long time to move through it. The board receives about $10 million per biennium in general fund dollars. Of that, $200,000 is for a program for Yoni's disease, and that is a disease that affects cattle. So cattle producers, the program is there to help them minimize the impact of that disease on their herds. $800,000 is for our Farm Survey program, and in there we do surveillance for both chronic wasting disease and TB on our farm servants. $5 million of that $10 million is for our efforts up in northwestern Minnesota to rid the state of bovine tuberculosis and bring the state back to TB-free status. So you can see that about half of our budget goes to that TB effort. $1 million of that $5 million for TB during the biennium is to pay producers an annual payment for staying out of the cattle business, the herds that went in the cattle herd buyout. Now, we have three other sources of income, or revenue, I should say, for the Board of Animal Health. The first is, in 2009, there was a one-time $1 assessment on the sale of cattle in the state, and that generated about $950,000 for the Board of Animal Health. That's in a special fund, and it hasn't all been spent. Some of that money is still available for that TB effort. We also collect fees from our Farm Survey producers, inspection fee, and that brings in about $90,000 every biennium.
And how much is that fee, Dr. Hartman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that fee is $10 per animal per year up to a maximum of $100. And then lastly, the other revenue source the board has is many of the programs we work on are national eradication programs, and so we work cooperatively with USDA on those programs, and we estimate, and I emphasize estimate, that in the next biennium we would be getting about approximately $2 million from the federal government for those cooperative programs. However, I would caution us all that the federal government is going through the same cost-cutting that we are, so that's a soft number. With that, I would take any questions about the overall budget of the Board of Animal Health, if you have any. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Dr. Thompson to talk about the governor's recommendation for the next biennium.
Dr. Hartman, do you have any idea how many deer you're testing now for the CWD?
Mr. Chairman, I've been following that very closely, hoping that we don't find any more positives. The last time I talked to DNR, they had tested about 350, and they were all negative. Okay. Their target is to test at least 900, but they don't intend to stop at 900. If they can get more, they want to get more.
Okay, and Dr. Hartman, I understand that there is a bit of a need for a quicker turnaround on this to allow the animals that do not test positive to allow that venison meat to be used in a sensible way. So that's my understanding. Is that correct, Bill?
Mr. Chairman, that's something that we should talk about. The resources of our veterinary diagnostic lab, which is the official lab of the Board of Animal Health, they're able to turn those samples. Well, first of all, they have the technology at that lab to do the testing for chronic wasting disease. And then once they do it, they will always adapt to whatever problem or issue that Minnesota has and quickly respond to it. So, yes, they're turning them around in 3 days, and then they are able to use the meat from the deer.
And, Dr. Hartman, are those tests on a per-fee basis, or is the DNR going to help with their budget challenges here?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that they are on a per-fee basis for those samples, but in talking to the director of the diagnostic lab, generally their fees cover their costs. They aren't making income from those tests.
So there's room for the DNR to help out some more then if we need it.
There's room for us all to help out.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Dr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to echo Dr. Hartman's appreciation.
Please state your name. And
Suppose you do need to know who I am. Dr. Beth Thompson, I'm a senior veterinarian for the Board of Animal Health. And again, I'd like to echo Dr. Hartman's appreciation for being here today. I'm just going to take a moment. As Dr. Hartman mentioned, our budget is fairly simple, and I'm just going to discuss the direct appropriations by fund. This is located on page 4 of your handout. And then I'm going to talk just for a few minutes about the board's plan for dealing with the governor's recommendation for the coming biennium. If you go to that page 4 up at the top, the direct appropriations from the general fund, you can see in fiscal year 2010, the appropriations were just over $5 million, and again in 2011 for a total biennium appropriation of $10.25 million. Now, the recommendation for the coming biennium is $4.841 million for each of the next coming years, fiscal year 2012 and 2013, so a total biennium appropriation of 9.682. This is a downward adjustment for the biennium of $514,000 or $257,000 per year. Having said that, I'd like to go through really a four-part plan or intentions of the board for dealing with the downward adjustment for the biennium. Three of my points dovetail together, so hopefully I can pull them out so you can understand exactly where I'm going with everything. First of all, as many of you probably realize, in addition to the employees that we have in our office in St. Paul, we also have a number of employees located throughout the state of Minnesota. We have agricultural specialists, agricultural technicians, and also district veterinarians. This coming year, one of our district veterinarians will be retiring. He's one of 9 district veterinarians after, I believe, it's 20 to 25 years of work with the Board of Animal Health. Now, it's the board's intention not to hire somebody to replace that district veterinarian. Rather, we will be redistricting our other field veterinarians, and the other veterinarians will take over that geographical region. In addition to that, we also utilize USDA federal veterinarians who are also out in the field. Secondly, I'd like to turn your attention to northwestern Minnesota. In October of 2010, the majority of the state of Minnesota enjoyed a status upgrade to TB-free. And that zone located in northwestern Minnesota went from modified accredited to modified accredited advance. With that upgrade, the requirement for 60-day or movement testing for feeder calves coming out of the greater modified accredited advance zone was eliminated. Now, we're still requiring testing for the management zone, that smaller zone where the TB-infected herds were found. But for the greater modified accredited advance zone, we no longer require that 60-day testing, thus decreasing some of the job duties for our employees that are located up in that area. Additionally, I was hired in the summer of 2008, and two portions of the TB eradication effort that I helped oversee were the fencing and buyout programs. Both of those programs, the bulk of the work for our employees happened in 2008, with some of it tailing into 2009. Now our employees are doing inspections on the premises where the buyout occurred and also where the fences were put up. But for the most part, the bulk of the work was located back in 2008 and 2009. I can't discuss northwestern Minnesota without bringing up the cooperation of the producers that we've seen up there since the program went into place. And again, I think back to the summer of 2008, the number of phone calls we received in our office. Our employees spent a lot of time out with the producers, you know, either setting up for whole herd testing, going over a movement certificate, or working with their inventories. But the producers have really stepped up to the plate, and the success of our TB eradication efforts, it wouldn't be complete without mentioning the producers in northwestern Minnesota. So having said that about the programs, we have 2 employees that are located in northwestern Minnesota, hired specifically for the TB eradication efforts. These two employees were hired on temporary 3-year contracts, and those contracts will be up this summer, again the summer of 2011. And it's the board's intention not to hire somebody to replace those two employees. Rather, we will have the other employees cross-trained and taking on the duties of the two employees that are leaving. We're fairly certain, because of the closeness geographically up in that area and the employees that have worked together now for a number of years, that the permanent employees will be able to pick up those job duties. Last point I'd like to go through is the amount of overtime for our employees located up in northwestern Minnesota. We've seen the amount of overtime for the employees needed to be claimed drop significantly in the past year. It's a rare instance now where our employees need to claim overtime. You know, they're just not doing testing on Saturdays or Sundays anymore. And we've really tried to work with the producers, and rather having whole herd testing happening through a couple of months in the year, we've tried to spread it out throughout the year. So those are the four areas that the board is going to work on to make adjustments to for the governor's proposal. I mean, first of all, we have a district vet that's retiring. We've got a change in our TB program activities, two employees on temporary contracts whose contracts will be up this year, and then a decrease in overtime. With that, that's all I have. If there are any questions.
Any questions for Dr. Thompson? Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to either one of the doctors. What's the status of the process for ensuring that the cattle that move into the state are bovine TB free, so that we can try to ensure that we don't have this again?
Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoey, that's an ongoing effort to make sure that this doesn't happen again. We have regulations for anything that's imported into Minnesota, so cattle imported into Minnesota have to come with a certificate of veterinary inspection. We do not have any TB testing requirements for states that are free. We are closely monitoring, though, the TB activity in other states. There have been a lot of other states that have found bovine tuberculosis in their cattle. Most recently, Indiana found another herd. So we're monitoring that closely. We do have regulations and testing requirements for Mexican cattle, Mexican origin cattle that come into the United States, that they be tested before they come into Minnesota twice. We also have some regulations for rodeo circuit cattle that come into Minnesota, that they get tested as well. But we're looking closely at would we want to have a TB test requirement for the import of any cattle. At this point, we haven't done it yet, but we're open to that possibility if the cattle industry wants to do it.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Hartman. And just one other thing. At what point in the movement of the cattle or the sale of the cattle is that paperwork inspected by someone? Could you help me out there a little bit?
Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoey, a very good question. That's something that we're in the process right now of tightening up. The way the certificates of veterinary inspection work is a veterinarian in another state fills out that certificate, and then they send it to the state a copy to their state office, and then from their Board of Animal Health, and then from there it comes to our office. Sometimes they don't come to us for months. Usually they're there within a couple of weeks, but not always. So we're looking at instituting an import permit system, so that whenever breeding cattle are coming into Minnesota, they have to call for a permit before they come in. And in that way, not only would we know about it right away, actually before they got there, but we'd also know exactly where they're going to in Minnesota. And I've had good feedback from the cattle industry that they're supportive of that idea.
Yeah, good question.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hartman. I would appreciate movement and progress on that area. I think that's very important.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Magnus. This is actually a question for Ms. Gothier. If you could, before you leave, if you could put on your department hat one more time.
Yes, ma'am.
I just had this is a great handout, and I'm wondering if you have an electronic link. Certainly many of us send out emails. We'd be glad to include an electronic link to this. If you could email that to us?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson, be happy to do that. It is located on our webpage also, and I can send you a link for that as well.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Beg your pardon, Senator?
Would you send that to everybody, please?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And I just want to make another comment again to Dr. Hartman and Dr. Thompson. That bovine TB effort was a great partnership between a lot of people, including the legislators. Those of you that were here, we stepped up, and the rest of the legislatures helped us in our hour of need. And I want to also thank Assistant Commissioner Martin, who was here a few weeks ago, talking about this. He led that effort at the department, and really a stand-up job, a great job. And I just want to congratulate you again on what we've done. But I have the same concern Senator Scoy has, that we have to be vigilant. We just can't let this go and work on that. So thank you very much for your presentation. Cool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, on that compliment, Dr. Hartman, is Indiana or other states in touch with you as to following the lead that you guys set forward with the processes and ways to control this? Is anybody working with Minnesota, or what are these other states doing to control bovine TB?
Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scoy, there is an organization of state veterinarians, and we meet regularly, and we have conference calls regularly to discuss these eradication programs. And so certainly we are sharing the information and what we learned with TB with all the other states. We're also, I was at a bi-national meeting with USDA with the Mexican delegation, and they're very interested in what Minnesota has done, and they're going to be sending 3 or 4 people up to visit with us to see how we got rid of TB. So we're getting the word out as much as we can. As far as what the other states are doing with TB, so far none of them have found it in the white-tailed deer. It's all been a cattle issue, so it's a little easier to deal with then. And none of them have found any spread of the disease in cattle either. They found individual herds that are infected. So far, nobody else has had quite the challenge that we have.
Thank you. And as the chair said, the board is really to be congratulated on this. You guys did a great job.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to some more discussions concerning our lab and other areas. So thank you very much for your work.
Mr. Chairman.
Your help.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dames, I think we'll bring your bill up next if you're ready to go. Members, you have the information in your packet concerning the bill offered today by Senator Dames, and I believe, Senator, your motion would if you would care to do so, would be to have the bill pass and sent to the Environment Committee.
Committee Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Senator Gary Dames, and I have with me today Jerry Schoenfeld, who will be testifying on behalf of the bill. This is Senate file number 123 that I'd like to introduce and ask for your passage. This bill is a bill for an act relating to county agricultural societies appropriating money from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Funds for grants to county agricultural societies. Also, there's an amendment. It's going to be an author's amendment. It's the A2 amendment that I would like to introduce to the committee in order to clean the bill up and get it in the order that we want it to be presented.
Okay. Senator Dames, first we'll take a motion. Our understanding is you're making a motion to recommend that House file, Senate file, 123 pass and be referred to an Environment Committee, number one.
That is
and
correct.
Number two, you're moving the A2 amendment, and members, that do you all have this in your possession? Filling in the numbers and going in a little more detail. Is that correct?
That is correct. And the numbers show the proposed usage. You should have received that sheet, and then also the breakdown of how we arrived at the dollar values. That should be in one sheet, front and back.
Okay, so first, members, will act on the, since the motion is a delete all amendment, we'll act on that amendment. All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. All right, the amendment passes, and Senator Dames, proceed with your bill now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Jerry Schoenfeldt to kind of go through the process in the bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeldt. I work with the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. And, you know, when fairs come up, what do most of us think about? And I just happen to think that when our grandest fair at the State Fair comes up every year, the first thing everybody thinks about is what's on the stick this year. And that is, in its own way, kind of an iconic cultural heritage that the Minnesota State Fair has put together, is the Great Minnesota Get-Together. But what a lot of people don't realize is that in order to have the Minnesota State Fair, all the county fairs throughout the state, there are 95 of them, come together and provide basically the feeder into the Minnesota State Fair. And if you actually look at the number of people that go through the gate at the county fairs, it's actually greater than the number of people that go through the state fair collectively. So they are a significant part. They go way back in our history and our heritage. Actually, I was told at one time, I believe it's the case, that one of the very first bills that the territorial legislature had passed was to help establish county agricultural societies. And there is, for many of you may know, there is a chapter of law called Chapter 38 that deals very specifically with county agricultural societies. And they are a quasi-form of government within our state laws. And so with that, I wanted to give you a little bit of that background and tell you that even though you might think about food on a stick, and by the way, I had a list here that was pretty amazing, caramel apple puppies and cheese pizza with corn dogs, chicken fried bacon, all those foods on the stick. In fact, with regard to county fairs, they have been a cultural center, a historical center, and an artistic center in our rural areas since the beginning of our statehood. And that is really what we're looking at and why we feel we qualify under the Cultural Heritage Act or the provisions, that we do provide those artistic areas, whether it's in competitions by 4-H kids or whether it's in competitions by open class. It is a centerpiece of our county fairs, and certainly the historical and cultural development areas of those as well. We sat down with the Minnesota Federation of County Fair Board of Directors and took a look at what they felt they would do with these funds. And you have ahead of you just a short list of some of those kinds of things. Some of them fit into kind of cultural areas and historical areas, and others in artistic areas. In terms of county fairs, they are multi-generational. Grandparents bring their grandkids, parents bring their kids, and so forth. They've been going on for a long time. And as I said, we have 95 county fairs, or 95 fairs in 87 counties, the largest of which is Steele County Fair down in Owatonna, which has a gate of about 300,000 people each year. So they're not necessarily small. In other cases, they might be down in the tens of thousands. And I guess one of the things that I know about these areas, there was recently a convention held in Bloomington in which 1,400 people showed up for the county fair convention at the Radisson, or I guess it's the Hilton now, whatever it is. In any case, the point is these are volunteers. These are people that put their heart and soul, and most of you that are from rural areas know that board of directors on county fairs really do put their heart and soul, and they spend years working for the development of giving back to the community through their county ag societies and county fairs. The bill that's before you really was developed upon three different areas. What was taking a look at was in one part bricks and mortar, and unlike other artistic areas such as the Guthrie Theater or some of the other kinds that you've seen that have been funded in the bonding bill, county fairs don't qualify for that kind of a thing. So we felt that bricks and mortar was appropriate in some cases out of the artistic and cultural fund. In other cases, it is for programming, working with youth, with adults, and thirdly, projects and events. And that is the basis upon what the bill before you is. I think that if you look at the background of the constitutional amendment that provides for the funds in this area, the arts and cultural heritage portion of the 3/8 cent that goes into this, the dedicated funds that passed in 2008 provides almost 20%, 19.75% of the total sales tax in that area goes into this area. If you take a look at the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund itself, in the last two appropriations, it was close to $100 million was spent in these areas. About half of it went to the Board of Arts and other areas as well. And we're asking to be a part of that to develop the arts, cultural, and historical heritages that our county fairs bring forth to our rural communities.
Any questions for Mr. Schoenfeld? By the way, Mr. Schoenfeld, you owe me a few minutes because you only gave me 5 minutes last night. Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman. But Mr. Chairman, I might remember you took 10 or 15.
Where'd I keep the score? Anyway, Senator Kielash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Schoenfeld, what I'm curious about is it seems like these are activities that are already going on at the fairs. I don't, and one of the other things is that most of the, almost all of the cultural heritage funds and Lessard funds and water are specifically based on projects. This is a general broadcast of the money. Is the second thing, but you know, are we getting anything more for this money, or are we getting the same thing only the legacy funds paying for it?
Mr. Chairman, it is not meant to supplant existing projects that are occurring. There is a list of projects that you may see, and you may have seen some of these kinds of things happening at fairs, but they're not happening at each and every one. And in many cases, it's a shortage of funds that would like them to expand in different areas. It's just a list that we put together as potential kinds of ideas that different people brought forth that they would like to do. And in fact, this list was things that some of our board of directors, for instance, in our fairs, may have seen at another fair but didn't have at their own fair. What they were asked to do when they put this list together was to come forth with things that they would like to add to their particular fair. And so I agree with you that some of these projects you may have seen at particular fairs, but they're not at all of them, and they were the intent would be to use those funds to provide additional things that are not already in existence. In terms of the bill itself, it does provide, for instance, in the $1.8 million section, it's based upon $75,000 at 25 different fairs for the artistic centers and performance stages and those kinds of things. I guess if you think of the state fair as an example, there are the cultural heritage section of the state fair. Many of our county fairs don't have those kind of things. They'd like to be able to add them at the county level. In the case of programming, it may be demonstrations, and even though you may see some of these kinds of things, as an example, art shows at the county fair, there's a lot of competition in artistic competition, whether it be photographs, whether it be paintings, those kinds of things. But one of the things that we don't have, because it's almost all volunteer, we don't have real artists that can come and be part of the education to these people that participate in these projects. And one of the kinds of things that was asked of would be done through this, very similar to what would be done through the Board of Arts as an example, only in a different area, would be that they would be hiring specific people to come and help that are professionals in these areas that would be able to help with these kinds of things to train or at least teach, educate people that are interested in these particular art arenas, whether they're creative arts such as or whether they are more traditional art. And so that kind of thing. The third thing in terms of the projects and events, again, more programmatic kind of things that would be involved with whether it's the 4-H or open class kinds of people at the fairs. And the last thing, yes, the last portion, the non-competitive grants to the promotion and development of access and education to the arts, agriculture, and historical interpretations, that is, in fact, a general $10,000 per fair. And it was just felt by our board of directors, and I'm sure you as legislators can take a little bit more in-depth look at, but they felt that kind of seed money to be used in these areas would be important rather than specific projects that they maybe had up front.
Okay, Senator Kielash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, the other question I have is, since this is arts and heritage funding, why is the Commissioner of Agriculture the one that's distributing the funds instead of going through the current system where we do fund the arts and designate something this way? It's like setting up a whole other group of people to do the disbursement of all those legacy funds as well. So it seems to me that this could the intent and could still be administered, and the law could still be administered through the current system of arts funding.
Well, Mr. Chairman, relative to the Department of Agriculture, the existing jurisdiction of the Department of Agriculture does have control over the county agricultural societies, and they already provide through. Matter of fact, it was mentioned earlier today that they do. There is a very small piece that provides for funding that goes into some of the 4-H competitions, and so we felt that the that they had experience with them, that they have contact with them, and that they were the most appropriate place to deal with them directly. It is true that you could put some of these things through the Arts Board, as an example, which gets about $21 million a year, I think, presently, at least under the law in the last 2 years. And, in fact, there's been a couple of cases where there's been some small grants, like $3,000 or something, that did go to some county fairs. But this is a situation that they really felt that they were as prominent, for instance, in their minds as the Arts Board in terms of providing these kinds of service to the local community, and that they could do it better this way rather than going through those kinds of other venues.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to respond to Senator Kielash's question earlier about if we'd be duplicating services that are there or just using the funds to pay for what's already there. Having sat on a county fair board for over 10 years, trust me, there's a lot of things that the county fair boards would like to do that they just cannot do because the funding isn't there. It's all volunteer labor. And we have a lot of folks that are in that young age with 4-H, FFA, open class, that really deserve the opportunity to see some of the arts and things like that that currently we're not able to offer at our county fairs. And this is another way to attract those folks and show them the arts and show them things like that. So I think it's a real opportunity for the county fair boards to do that. And I think you can rest assured that you don't have to worry about this money just being used to pay for something we already have, because a lot of these programs can only be offered in a real short version and once or so at each fair because they just don't have the money to continue them. This would help continue some of those programs, build on them, and really build something that would be of good for our young folks at these fairs.
Okay. Senator Kielash?
Senator Dames, I think part of my point on this is that if you want to bring artists to the fairs, the Arts Board and the people that are working with the artists currently would probably have a great opportunity to help set up these artists, already know who would be effective at the different fairs for the kind of very things that you're talking about. So the Agriculture Commission and the societies wouldn't necessarily have to duplicate that service. It's as much about how we administer these funds and how many different people are overseeing them, tearing them apart, whatever. I don't disagree that maybe there's a certain amount of funding that could go directly to the agriculture boards. I just think it ought to, instead of create a whole new thing with the Department of Agriculture, it can go through the current system.
Well, I think one of the reasons we're suggesting you go to the Department of Agriculture is because, as I said, the county fair boards are volunteer. They're used to working in the Department of Agriculture with different programs, and I think it's a natural fit for that with these boards that currently are working with the Department of Agriculture with some of these programs. So that's why I would suggest that it go with the Department of Agriculture. But I do understand your comments and where you're coming from, and I certainly respect that.
I think, gentlemen, we'll see what the next committee has to say about that. They'll have a better handle on it than I do, certainly, but there's some points that are up. Senator Rosen, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I was just the author basically said what I was going to say. We all around this table have many county fairs, and they're all wonderful, and it is the highlight of the summer, and many people make their vacations around the county fairs. Many are in peril because they do not have an endowment of some kind that carries them through.
and very competitive basis, these county fairs, and this is where people go, and they're still very popular. So, Senator Kielash, I welcome you out to Martin County Fair, because they are the next biggest fair in the state of Minnesota. You know, Steele pretends they are, but Martin County is actually it. So
you come on down.
You're going to steal some people from Steele County. Okay. Does anyone else wish to testify on the bill? I don't see anyone to testify. Senator Dames, would you care to renew your motions that the bill pass and be sent to the Environment Committee?
Mr. Chairman, if there's no further discussion,
as amended,
I move that Senate File 123, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee.
Okay. All those in favor of said motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Aye.
The bill passes. We've got two more bills. I'll trade seats with you, Senator Dames, if you would.
Senator Magnus, when you're ready to present your bill.
Thank you, Senator Dean. Or Mr. Chairman, I would offer up Senate File 397. Frankly, both of these bills, I'm going to make the motion that we hold these bills over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill as we go on. And at this point, I do not have numbers to fill in until we get a better handle on our targets and what we're going to do here. We don't have the ability to put the numbers in that we need at this time, but Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to get this in front of the committee to talk about possibly including these in our omnibus bill. The first one is the Agri program. We just had testimony on that, Mr. Chairman and members, from the department. Remember, you may recall last year we had, our last session, we had about $3 million for Next Generation Energy Board and other issues. I think those are important for us to continue. I do believe it will help us in our negotiations over the target if we have some of these specific programs in there. Members, we're going to have to explain to the other members of the Senate what we're doing with this money. So, Mr. Chairman, I would offer up Senate File 397 for possible inclusion in the omnibus agriculture and rural economies omnibus bill.
Thank you, Senator Magnus. Do any members have any questions on Senate File 397? There being no questions, Senator Magnus, do you renew your motion to?
Yes, I would. Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we vote on this bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus ag and rural economies bill.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Senate File 397 will be referred to the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will also make the same motion for Senate File 192 to approve for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. This is the livestock investment grants. Earlier testimony from the department today described that. Again, this is something we've been doing in the past. Hopefully we can continue some of these programs to support our livestock industry, and we'll have more discussions on that. And again, as we get a better handle on our fiscal targets for the committee. So that's my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions by the members?
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes,
thank
sir.
You, Mr. Chair. Senator Magnus, good luck in your discussions with Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, I sit on the committee, so hopefully that'll help us. But we need to keep some items out here for the future of agriculture. And just because we're sitting, you know, in fairly good times right now, doesn't mean we will be next year. We know how cyclical this is, and we need to just keep supporting this because we, you know, if we didn't have a strong agriculture, where would we be today in the economy, and especially for an agricultural dependent state like we are? So,
Senator Nino, did you have a question? Any other members have any questions on Senate File 192? There being no other questions, Senator Magnus, you reaffirm your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will move Senate File Number 192 be approved for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Agriculture and Rural Economies Bill.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Senate File 192 will be looked at for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Senate File 192 does carry.
And, Mr. Chairman, just a couple announcements. We will not be meeting next week as a committee. We was hoping to do the clean water thing on next week, but that's going to be delayed until the week after. And so we will not be meeting next week. We're working on other issues. And if you have ideas to talk about for bills and anything else, please get those in. We'll be moving along pretty rapidly now after next week. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Magnus. There being no other business to come before the Committee on Agriculture and Rural Economies, we'll declare the meeting adjourned.